Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things. The Hemingway. Today we will be reading chapter 30 and discussing chapter 29. Do you love how prepared I am when I hit record and start talking? So prepared. Ready to go. Alright, chapter 29. The questions that I asked you guys were these. Is anyone else starting to feel like Heathcliff is getting away with too much too easily? Number 2. Heathcliff is into ghosts. Cool. This book suddenly became very gothic. Discuss. And did Heathcliff really just complain that it was difficult for him to beat his invalid son without killing him and expect sympathy? Swim, said the Mama Fishy, said, I have developed a liking for Catherine too, Catherine the Second. So far, she is the only one to experience positive growth and change. She shows an understanding of Linton and why he is the way he is, calls out Heathcliff regarding why he is such a miserable human being, and leaves her home with her head held high. As I've said before, I think Hemingway was drawn to the story because of all the outsized emotions and drama, and admirable that in 1934 he put this book by a woman writer with not much experience on a list of books essential to read. I think Bronte's accomplishment is impressive for her life and times. Techrific responded saying, well, I'd like to nominate Harriton to this award, or maybe we could split it. Both of them have been showing encouraging signs of development, both Harriton and Cathy, number 2. And in response to Swim said the Mama Fishy's comment, I think Bronte's accomplishment is impressive for her life and times. Techrific said, hear, hear. Swim said the Mama Fishy agreed, I agree with you, Harriton is also showing encouraging signs. I need to watch my absolutist statements. Yeah, they are both looking, showing some redeeming qualities. I think that's the kindest thing I can say. Some redeeming qualities. I liked Cathy in this previous chapter, standing up to Harriton. No, sorry, to Heathcliff. Standing up to him, standing her ground, calling him out. The thing I didn't like was how she's kind of excusing Linton's poor behavior by understanding how it came about. She's almost saying, oh, I understand why it's this way, and therefore it's okay. I kind of disagree with that second part. I think he doesn't deserve that consideration because he's really stepped past that mark where it's redeemable. He's acted very, very selfishly. I think when someone is, I think, you know, if he changed his ways and showed remorse and tried to change, then you might be able to say, okay, you're making an effort to be better, and I can see why you were bad in the first place, and it was to do with, you know, forces outside of your control during your upbringing, and now you're trying to be better. But the problem is I'm not seeing him trying to be better. That's the issue that I have. So I still think he's just a bad person still, and he's not making an effort to do better. I mean, that's pretty unsympathetic, especially considering, like, the boy's on his deathbed, pretty much. He's on death row, and he doesn't have much to be optimistic about, but, yeah, I don't know. I think Cathy is a godsend, and he's just so mean to her. He should be over the moon to have someone like that in his life. Techrific said, I wonder what unspeakable punishment Heathcliff inflicted on Linton. Not that he is entirely undeserving, but what a sadist like Heathcliff can conjure up in his twisted mind is chilling to me. Gothic tales often involve ghosts, and they invariably are symbols of the past that the protagonist and antagonists must overcome to move into the future. Lockwood, only Lockwood, and Heathcliff have seen Ghost Catherine, and I don't know what to make of that, but they could perhaps be seen as the protagonist and antagonist of the story. That's an interesting take. I suppose you could call them the protagonist and antagonist, although they aren't in direct conflict with each other, which is an interesting kind of structure there. In a way, the whole previous generation can be seen as spectres that haunt the new generation of Harriton, Linton and Kathy. They sort of mirror each other in spooky ways, both in their behaviour and and what befalls them in life. Regarding Anders' third discussion prompt, he did indeed complain, and apparently all is forgiven because he's pining for dead Catherine, and he has suffered so much pain and anguish. Well, boo-hoo, cry me a river, allez le violin. He's actually whining like Linton in this chapter. Maybe he was trying to manipulate Nelly one last time, but I doubt even Nelly could buy what he's selling. He's got feelings, give the man an award. He's also a cruel little prick that gets away with literally anything. Is my suspension of disbelief lifted? I don't know. I'm guessing it's a small town, isolated. Heathcliff is now the only landowner around, so he's the elite, top of the food chain, apex predator of the area. What can the little folks do? Get their pitchforks out? Yeah, all right. I'm going to come along that on that ride with you, Tech, and try to suspend my disbelief a little bit longer and say it was a very different time, and they are in a very isolated place. Both things might factor into how he is getting away with such awful behavior, because it was, to be honest, it was starting to get in the way of the story a little bit for me, like just how much he was getting away with, and it just seemed like in a modern setting, you just point to him and be like, yeah, that guy, and that would be the end of him. Whereas in this setting, he's just kind of, you know, he's got bigger muscles than everyone else and therefore does literally anything he wants. But I don't want it to get in the way of the story. I want to come along for the ride, so I'm going to jump on that train with you, jump on that train of thought, and go along with you there. You get a pass this time, Bronte and Heathcliff. I'm still on board. Wasm said, I'm curious how the story will proceed now that Nelly is out of the picture. Will she be receiving secretive letters sneaked out of Wuthering Heights or retelling rumours heard around town? There's always Lockwood as well, who may go back and find out that last part of the story, or we may proceed into the future with only vague details of what exactly happened. I really hope we go into the future. Like, I really want to see, you know, I don't want to just get up to the present and then that's it. And then it's like, yep, no, and that's the story of this town. From the starting point, I kind of wanted to know what happens next in Lockwood's situation. So I'm really worried we won't find out Lockwood's story, his ongoing story. We are nearing the end. What is there, like 6 or 7 chapters left? Not that many. I just want to throw back to another response we had about why Hemingway might have chosen to put this book on his list. Swim said the Mama Fishy said this, and it didn't quite make it. This comment didn't quite come through in time for the episode in which we discussed it. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, Ernest Hemingway was a man who lived life very passionately in a big masculine way, but yet he was drawn to a book written by a young woman who, as we have seen, writes in a big passionate way in what is arguably a female romanticized style. I think he admired her boldness in writing such unconventional characters in the mid-19th century. He obviously read broadly and deeply, and now so are we. Huh. That's really cool. We are too. We are reading broadly and deeply too in the prescribed manner by Ernest Hemingway. That's such a cool thought, right? I think that's such a cool thing. He did live in a very passionate and masculine way. And I think I really admire him that there's a lot of talk about like toxic masculinity recently, and I think it seems to me like to put those words together like that implies that masculinity is in itself toxic. It's like saying, I don't know. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to think of another example, but I don't want to go ahead and say anything because I feel like it's just going to, derail my point more than anything. But you know what I mean? It's those two words linked together can be a problem, I think, because then people start to interpret it as masculinity. Any observable act of masculinity must inherently be toxic, and they start saying, like, you know, oh, that guy's got his legs spread a little bit apart on the train, that's toxic, you know. And or, you know, look at those guys at the gym hitting the punching bag, that there are, you know, they're competing, seeing who can hit it the hardest. Toxic masculinity, where it's like, I don't think it is. I think men are naturally competitive, you know. We've got testosterone, which makes us competitive. It's sort of a natural thing, and normal amount of masculinity and more normal masculine behavior is, I think it's refreshing to behold in its natural state, you know. You know, when you see something and you're like, that's as it should be kind of thing, like that makes sense in the wild. As it should be maybe sounds a bit presumptuous. But do you know what I mean? Like when you see something like that and, I don't know, like that makes sense to me. Like two kids playing a competitive sport, you know, and they're exercising that competitive nature. What am I trying to say here? I really like that about Hemingway. I think that's why he's always been a bit of an icon of mine, is because he expressed masculinity he just expressed it in a way that I found admirable. Now, I'm sure if you analysed his behaviour, you could find some encounters where he did something awful, or, you know, said something awful, or treated someone in an awful way. You know, he was a person who lived a full life, so, you know, anyone, if you scrutinize him, you can find some problems. But I don't know, he was like a man's man, you know? You know that term, man's man? I don't even know if he's probably not even allowed to say that anymore. But I always thought, I would have loved to have had a drink with him, had a beer with him, you know, and gone to his favourite sport, which was the running of the bulls, and, you know, just had that flood of adrenaline, that flood of testosterone, celebration of masculinity. I think that's quite an awesome thing. And I think he recognised that, and he recognised its equal counterpart of the full celebration of femininity. And, as Fishy said, female romanticized style. So yeah, I think that might be something to do with why he's chosen this book. He might see a bit of a kindred spirit with Bronte. Sorry, this was rather a pointless rant. It's one of those topics I feel like I need to tiptoe around because I don't want to put my foot in my mouth, so to speak. Yeah. I'm trying to express that I admire his masculinity in a way that doesn't make me look like some kind of anti-feminist person or something like that. I think we should continue on with the book and read chapter 20. No, sorry, not chapter 29. Read chapter 30. Chapter 30 goes a little bit like this. I have paid a visit to the Heights, but I have not seen her since she left. Joseph held the door in his hand, and when I called to ask after her, he wouldn't let me pass. He said Mrs. Linton was thrang, and the master was not in. Zella has told me something of the way they go on, otherwise I should hardly know who was dead or who was living. She thinks Catherine haughty and does not like her, I can guess by her talk. My young lady asked some aid of her when she first came, but Mr. Heathcliff told her to follow her own business and let his daughter-in-law look after herself, and Zillah willingly acquiesced, being a narrow-minded, selfish woman. Catherine evinced a child's annoyance at this neglect, repaid it with contempt, and thus enlisted my informant among her enemies as securely as if she had done her some great wrong. I had a long talk with Zillah about 6 weeks ago, a little before you came, one day when we four gathered on the moor, and this is what she told me. The first thing Mrs. Linton did, she said, on her arrival at the Heights, was to run upstairs without even wishing good evening to me and Joseph. She shut herself into Linton's room and remained till morning. Then, while the master and Earnshaw were at breakfast, she entered the house and asked all in a quiver if the doctor might be sent for. Her cousin was very ill. "We know that," answered Heathcliff, "but his life is not worth a farthing, and I won't spend a farthing on him." "But I cannot tell how to do," she said, "and if nobody will help me, he'll die." "Walk out of the room," cried the master, "and let me never hear a word more about him." "None here care what becomes of him. If you do, act the nurse. If you do not, lock him up and leave him." Then she began to bother me, and I said I had enough plague with the tiresome thing. We each had our tasks, and hers was to wait on Linton. Mr. Heathcliff bid me leave that labour to her. How they managed together I can't tell. I fancy he fretted a great deal, and moaned himself night and day, and she had precious little rest. One could guess by her white face and heavy eyes. She sometimes came into the kitchen and wilded like, and looked as if she would fain beg assistance, but I was not going to disobey the master. I never dared disobey him. Mrs. Dean, and though I thought it wrong that Kenneth should not be sent for, it was no concern of mine either to advise or complain, and I always refused to meddle. Once or twice after we had gone to bed, I've happened to open my door again and seen her sitting crying on the stairs top, and then I've shut myself in quick for fear of being moved to interfere. I did pity her then, I'm sure. Still, I didn't wish to lose my place, you know. At last, one night she came boldly into my chamber and frightened me out of my wits by saying, "Tell Mr. Heathcliff that his son is dying. I'm sure he is this time. Get up instantly and tell him." Having uttered this speech, she vanished again. I lay a quarter of an hour listening and trembling. Nothing stirred. The house was quiet. "She's mistaken," I said to myself. "He's got over it." I needn't disturb them, and I began to doze. But my sleep was marred a second time by a sharp ringing of the bell. The only bell we have, put on purpose for Linton, and the master called to me to see what was the matter, and informed them that he wouldn't have that noise repeated. I delivered Catherine's message, he cursed to himself, and in a few minutes came out with a lighted candle, and proceeded to their room. I followed. Mrs. Heathcliff was seated by the bedside, with her hands folded on her knees. Her father-in-law went up, held the light to Linton's face, looked at him and touched him. Afterwards he turned to her. "Now, Catherine," he said, "how do you feel?" She was dumb. "How do you feel, Catherine?" he repeated. "He's safe and I'm free," she answered. "I should feel well, but," she continued, with a bitterness she couldn't conceal, "have you left me so long to struggle against death alone that I feel and see only death?" "I feel like death." And she looked like it too. I gave her a little wine. Harriton and Joseph, who had been wakened by the ringing and the sound of feet, and heard our talk from outside, now entered. Joseph was fain, I believe, of the lad's removal. Harriton seemed, I thought, bothered, though he was more taken up with staring at Catherine than thinking of Linton. But the master bid him get off to bed again. We didn't want his help. He afterwards made Joseph remove the body to his chamber, and told me to return to mine, and Mrs. Heathcliff remained by herself. In the morning he sent me to tell her she must come down to breakfast. She had undressed and appeared going to sleep, and said she was ill, at which I hardly wondered. I informed Mr. Heathcliff, and he replied, "Well, let her be till the afternoon, and go up now and then to get her what is needful, and, as soon as she seems better, tell me." Kathy stayed upstairs a fortnight, according to Zilla, who visited her twice a day, and would have been rather more friendly, but her attempts at increasing kindness were proudly and promptly repelled. Heathcliff went up once to show her Linton's will. He had bequeathed the whole of his, and what had been her movable property, to his father. The poor creature was threatened and coaxed into that act during her week's absence, when his uncle died. The lands, being a minor, he could not meddle with. However, Mr. Heathcliff was claimed, and kept them in his wife's right, and his also, I suppose legally at any rate. Catherine, destitute of cash and friends, cannot disturb his possession. Sorry for the little chime there, that was just my computer speaking to me. Nobody, said Zilla, ever approached her door, except that once, but I, and nobody asked anything about her. The first occasion of her coming down into the house was on a Sunday afternoon. She had cried out, when I carried up her dinner, that she couldn't bear any longer being in the cold, and I told her the master was going to Thrushcross Grange, and Earnshaw and I needn't hinder her for descending. So, as soon as she heard Heathcliff's horse trot off, she made her appearance, donned in black, and her yellow curls combed back behind her ears as plain as a Quaker. She couldn't comb them out. Joseph and I generally go to chapel on Sundays. The Kirk, you know, has no minister now, explained Mrs. Dean, and they call the Methodists or Baptists place, I can't say which it is, at Gimmerton a chapel. Joseph had gone, she continued, but I thought proper to be bide at home. Young folks are always the better for an elder's overlooking, and Harriton, with all his bashfulness, isn't a model of nice behaviour. I let him know that his cousin would very likely sit with us, and she had been always used to see the Sabbath respected. So he had as good leave his guns and bits of indoor work alone while she stayed. He coloured up at the news, and cast his eyes over his hands and clothes. The train oil and gunpowder were shoved out of sight in a minute. I saw he meant to give her his company, and I guessed by his way he wanted to be presentable. So, laughing, as I durst not laugh when the master is by, I offered to help him, if he would, and joked at his confusion. He grew sullen and began to swear. Now, Mrs. Dean, Zilla went on, seeing me not pleased by her manner, you happen think your young lady too fine for Mr. Harriton, and happen you're right, but I own I should love well to bring her pride a peg lower. And what will all her learning and her daintiness do for her now? She's as poor as you or I, poorer, I'll be bound, you're saying, and I'm doing my little all that road. Harriton allowed Zilla to give him her aid, and she flattered him into a good humour. So, when Catherine came, half forgetting her former insults, he tried to make himself agreeable by the housekeeper's account. Missus walked in, she said, as chill as an icicle, and as high as a princess. I got up and offered her my seat in the armchair. No, she turned up her nose at my civility. Earnshaw rose too and bid her come to the settle and sit close by the fire. He was sure she was starved. I've been starved a month or more, she answered, resting on the word as scornful as she could. And she got a chair for herself and placed it at the distance from both of us. Having sat till she was warm, she began to look round and discovered a number of books on the dresser. She was instantly upon her feet again, stretching to reach them, but they were too high up. Her cousin, after watching her endeavours a while, at last summoned courage to help her. She held her frock, and he filled it with the first that came to hand. That was a great advance for the lad. She didn't thank him. Still, he felt gratified that she had accepted his assistance, and ventured to stand behind as she examined them, and even to stoop and point out what struck his fancy in certain old pictures which they contained. Nor was he daunted by the saucy style in which she jerked the page from his finger. He contented himself with going a bit farther back and looking at her instead of the book. She continued reading, or seeking for something to read. His attention became by degrees quite centred in the study of her thick, silky curls, her face he couldn't see and she couldn't see him, and perhaps not quite awake to what he did, but attracted like a child to a candle, at last he proceeded from staring to touching. He put out his hand and stroked one curl, as gently as if it were a bird. He might have stuck a knife into her neck. She started round in such a taking. "Get away this moment. How dare you touch me? Why are you stopping there?" she cried, in a tone of disgust. "I can't endure you. I'll go upstairs again, if you come near me." Mr. Harrington recoiled, looking as foolish as he could do. He sat down in the settle very quiet, and she continued turning over her volumes another half hour. Finally, Earnshaw crossed over and whispered to me, "Will you ask her to read to us, Zillah? I'm stalled of doing naught, and I could like to hear her. Dunnot say I wanted it, but ask for of yourself." "Mr. Harrington wishes you would read to us, ma'am," I said immediately. "He'd take it very kind. He'd be much obliged." She frowned, and looking up, answered, "Mr. Harrington and the whole set of you will be good enough to understand that I reject any pretense at kindness you have at the hypocrisy to offer. I despise you, and will have nothing to say to any of you. When I would have given my life for one kind word, even to see one of your faces, you all kept off, but I won't complain to you. I'm driven down here by the cold, not either to amuse you or enjoy your society." "What could I have done?" began Earnshaw. "How was I to blame?" "Oh, you are an exception," answered Mrs. Heathcliff. "I never missed such a concern as you." "But I offered more than once, and asked," he said, kindling up at her pertness. "I asked Mr. Heathcliff to let me wake for you." "Be silent. I'll go outdoors, or anywhere, rather than have your disagreeable voice in my ear," said my lady. Harrington muttered she might go to hell for him, and unslinging his gun, restrained himself from his Sunday occupations no longer. He talked now freely enough, and she presently saw fit to retreat to her solitude. But the frost had set in, and in spite of her pride, she was forced to condescend to our company more and more. However, I took care there should be no further scorning at my good nature. Ever since, I've been as stiff as herself, and she has no lover or liker among us, and she does not deserve one, for let them say the least word to her, and she'll curl back without respect for anyone. She'll snap at the master himself, and as good as dares him to thrash her, and the more hurt she gets, the more venomous she grows. At first, on hearing this account from Zillah, I determined to leave my situation, take a cottage, and get Catherine to come and live with me, but Mr. Heathcliff would as soon permit that as he would set up Harrington in an independent house, and I can see no remedy at present unless she could marry again, and that scheme it does not come within my province to arrange. Thus ended Mrs. Dean's story. Notwithstanding the doctor's prophecy, I am rapidly recovering strength, and though it be only the second week in January, I propose getting out on horseback in a day or two, and riding over to Wuthering Heights to inform my landlord that I shall spend the next 6 weeks in London, and if he likes, he may look out for another tenant to take the place after October. I would not pass another winter here for much. All right, there we go, another chapter down. And hey, right at the end there, we've swapped back to present tense. We're back with Lockwood. He's making future plans. That is music to my ears. I really hope we have him as a narrator now. And see what happens henceforth. That would be really cool. Ooh, that's actually got me a little bit excited. The very last bit of that chapter is what got me going, because, yeah, like, I want to move forward from the present time where the novel started. And I think a few other people had the same feeling. Well, that's kind of exciting. Pretty happy with that. Have your say about this chapter at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Thank you all very much for listening. We are starting The Brothers Karamazov in about a week. About a week, okay? So we're looking at, I'm going to say, maybe the 14th of March. 14th of March, approximately. Give or take a day or two. I'm not sure how long the rest of this book will take. But We've got a week, okay, and I know a lot of people are interested in reading this book, doing a read-along of The Brothers Karamazov. So I'm going to post a cross link over on the A Year of War and Peace subreddit and see if anyone over there is interested. I know we've got Brian E. Denton. He's going to be joining us. Brian E. Denton is a really great person to have on board. He was the guy who kind of started A Year of War and Peace in a sense. You know, he didn't start the subreddit or anything, but he has been reading War and Peace one chapter per day for like 7 years or something. Right. So last year when he did it, I think this is right. I think it was the sixth year in a row he'd done it. So he hadn't not read a chapter of War and Peace for 6 years, which is just awesome. And he reads all the different translations, all the different English translations. And he's written a really good blog about every single chapter, a blog for each chapter of War and Peace, like a summary kind of blog, which is also called A Year of War and Peace. He's a very knowledgeable man when it comes to Russian literature, War and Peace especially, but in general. And so he's excited to join us for The Brothers Karamazov. So I think that's a really cool thing. We're going to have some really good conversation with Brian involved as well. So with a week to go, it's a good opportunity, it's a good time to start to spread the word a little bit. So if you can think of a way to help do that, if you maybe know anyone who might be interested in doing the read-along for the Dostoevsky book, please spread the word in whatever way you see fit. I would be very, very grateful for that. Other than that, thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.